Hey there, lovely listeners, it's Dimitris here, and I have something exciting to announce before we begin episode 36. On December 15th, at the University of Sussex in Brighton, we are going to hold our very first physical event, which is super exciting. It's called Symposium on Continuities, Disruptions, and Management in the Sharing Economy, and we're essentially going to continue the conversation that we've had in episode 18, and also in this episode that you're about to listen to. Now, you can learn more about this event on our website or by going to the events website, which is oldwinenewbottles.com, where you can also register. So if you'd like to learn more about sharing economy, gig economy, things like Uber, Deliveroo, and the labor relations, as well as implications to organizational studies of these things, then definitely see if you can attend. We have an exciting lineup. We have Professor Natalia Levina from New York University. We have Sarah O'Connor from Financial Times, and it is her article that we discussed way back in episode 18. And we also have Ariana coming back, who was a guest on that episode, as well as a number of other very wonderful people, and I just can't wait to have all the amazing discussions. Now, the event is free to attend, but spaces are limited, so do register in advance. We're about half full now. And the deadline to register is 10th of November. All you have to do is just basically tell us why attending this event would be of benefit to you. There is a small amount of funds available to cover some travel expenses for PhD students and early career researchers. This is provided with the generous support of the Society for the Advancement of Management Studies, who are the primary sponsor for this event. So thank you very much, SAMS. Anyway, check out the website, either by going to talkingaboutorganizations.com and clicking on the red banner on top, you can't miss it, or by going to oldwinenewbottles.com, and that will basically take you there as well. All right, hope to see you in December, and enjoy this upcoming episode. It was really fun.
Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 36, where we are discussing Peter Fleming's The Human Capital Hoax, Work, Debt, and Insecurity in the Era of Uberization, published in the Journal of Organization Studies in 2017. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Ralph Soule coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico during the Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta.
Wow.
This is Joe Bradley coming to you from sunny and warm Melbourne, Florida.
And this is Pedro coming to you from a delightful gray day in Warwick University in the UK.
And this is Tom Galvin calling you from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where it is unfortunately dreary and raining today.
Well, that's quite the gamut of environmental conditions. I want to start out just giving a brief overview of the text that we're talking about today, the Human Capital Hoax. And it's similar to our, we'll talk about this later in the podcast, but it is related to our episode 18 about the gig economy and labor relations in the era of algorithmic management. Human capital theory is just one of the manifestations of a set of what the author refers to as neoclassical economic ideas that accentuate self-interest and individualism, and as he refers to them, as the only way to envision the organization of work. The author terms this the radical responsabilization of the workforce, and this links it to insecurity, low productivity, diminished autonomy, and very high levels of personal debt incurred for the investment education that employees make. Author sees this as clearly bad for employees and also leads to dumbing down of work. And one of the big issues and questions raised in the article is, fundamentally, is human capital a public or a private good? Because depending on how you answer that question or see the answer to that question or think about that question will lead you to very, very different concepts about what the role of the government is versus the individual or organizations in developing human capital.
Can I rewind a bit the conversation?
Yes, go right ahead.
I just would like to provide some contextual background about the text. The text was written by Peter Fleming and was published by Organizational Studies. which is the flagship journal of the European Group for Organizational Studies. This text was the runner-up in an essay competition held by the Social Research Foundation, and the topic for the competition was autonomy and organization. Peter Fleming is currently professor of business and society at Cass Business School and is associated to, well, largely at least, the critical management scholar community. And I think this essay in particular kind of translates this kind of research, as we see the author kind of trying to reread phenomena and try to tease out issues related to domination and control and, you know, related matters. I think that's what I had.
Thanks, Peter. That's very helpful. All right. So the author basically starts with a review of human capital theory and work and working class versus corporate class. And he does touch on Taylor and emerging ideas of work. In fact, there's another essay we'll link to later. It refers to as this post-Fordism, where the nature of the employment contract between the worker and the individual is significantly different than what it's been in the past. And this is not a new phenomenon. This has been something that's been developing over decades. And Fleming traces its origins back to an economic conference, and various widely known economic scholars, several that have actually won Nobel Prizes for their work, not necessarily on human capital theory. And the fundamental issue, as I said earlier, was this idea of, you know, what is human capital and who's responsible for developing it, and is it a purely public or private good? And Fleming refers to conversations that occurred during this conference between some of the economists over what the implications of that would be. And the way Fleming sees it is, if you strictly consider human capital, and that is somebody's knowledge and skills and abilities that are not intrinsic to them. And if anybody wants to help me out with that definition, that might be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me, how about take it this way? One of the things that I think was very useful when he was discussing the views of the economic theorists, it was the emergence of an idea of responsible autonomy as a good. Let's not worry about public versus private, but a notion that the workers would be more satisfied, more effective, more efficient, more whatever, in a situation where they had far greater autonomy and were able to use it responsibly. And this was a philosophical undertone, I think, that was different, was supposed to be a marked difference or a improvement over what had come from Taylorism. The idea being that if you gave workers this autonomy, then good things would come of it. Workers would be more satisfied because they would have more control over their own work sphere, and management would be more satisfied because they would see greater commitment of members who would essentially reward the company for being granted this autonomy. So this provided sort of the philosophical foundation for what would eventually come as human capital theory, which was an attempt to try to formalize it or to explain a way to operationalize the philosophy. That was kind of the takeaway I took from the beginning of the article.
Yeah, and I think that's a better way to say it than just a public or private good. I think that comes out of the conversation of how is that autonomy created and what's the best way for the workers to contribute to the organization. It's still an important point, but I think you're right to focus on, hey, that's what comes first, is this idea of responsible autonomy, because it would move work from this corporate controlled culture or the Taylorism model where you're not expected to think and let employees contribute their best skills.
Right. No, I was just going to say the article then gets into how human capital theory emerged from the 1990s onward and became manifest in deregulation, the gig economy. Some of those manifestations we're seeing now that are now the effects of which spurred the production of this article.
Mm. Well, I kind of read this in a different way, and I think maybe because I saw the name Peter Fleming, and I know that's going to be a critical reading of something, so I didn't even consider the extent that the human capital theory or notion might be linked with this idea of responsible autonomy, you know, which, when you said it, does make sense. I went straight to, you know, the way he mobilizes it and is trying to, you know, turn it upside down and show the darker aspects and how much it has served as justification for the current, I would say, well, the term he uses is uberization, but we can just say the individualization or the kind of rearrangements in the employment contract in which people are, well, they end up being considered contractors and don't have any kind of certainties or securities and have to carry all the risks of the work. So I kind of didn't see how much this theory could go both ways, so to speak. You know, I kind of, you know, got hooked into the way he's reading that.
I think that's a good point. And oftentimes, the idea of this autonomy provided by subcontracting or, you know, treating employees as subcontractors, which the author does address, is often portrayed as an unalloyed good in the economy. And I think it was good that Fleming brings forth that what you call a darker side, Pedro. And in fact, we're now into this part of the article section called Poverty of Human Capital Theory. And they talk about he reviews these dark sides, this idea that it can actually lead to lower incomes and people putting in more hours at work to get the outcomes. And there was a recent case of the people who were Uber drivers that figured out that for their compensation, they were making less than minimum wage, which, mm-hmm. which was pretty shocking. And then he also refers to the debt when you say that, well, organizations or governments are not going to fund this development of human capital, even though they take advantage of it and benefit greatly. And if you then go to the maybe it's not an extreme, but if you go to the end of the spectrum, it says all of that is the employee's responsibility. Then you talk about the debt that they incur for doing this, and idea that they have to make these investments up front before they necessarily have income to pay off the debt. And I think that's an important point that is I actually didn't until this article hadn't really connected that with the debt, educational debt people are incurring to the uberization or the responsabilization of work.
I think one of the challenges when we're discussing things such as, say, the rise of education costs or what have you, is that there's certainly other factors that may go outside of the theory that are contributing to that. So just simple economic forces. So perhaps what we can do is highlight a couple of the specific aspects of the theory as Fleming has laid it out, and then we can critique it, that sort of give us a sense of what the theorists thought were the benefits of the theory, and then we can move over and talk more critically about, well, how did these dark themes emerge? And it's basically page 695 in the article, and the first item that Fleming highlights was the notion of the individual contract. And you can see how the benefits of this would be seen as potentially good going on this autonomy theme, whereas instead of somebody being locked in and under the complete and total control of a firm in terms of their what they contribute, what skills they would have, or what have you, basically you're in a box, you're going to be stuck in a box. The idea of providing some sort of an ability for the individuals to have a say-so in what they do, how they do it, fair compensation for what they're providing, that would seem to be beneficial. And so if I feel like I am stuck, or I've got a glass ceiling over my head in this particular organization or this particular firm, I can move to another firm. I could simply pursue set up a contract with another firm, and it would give me the opportunity to, say, advance. I could seek promotion in a firm where I could not get promoted where I currently sit because there's just too many people in the queue or what have you. So that I thought was a powerfully appealing idea, I believe. How do you all take that?
I totally agree. And again, I'm thankful for your reading because I kind of, you know, it isn't the text, but I kind of it's more or less ignored that part, and I just took as a context. But I and this links with our episode, two episodes ago, on episode 34, in which we're discussing autonomy and the extent in which organizations control the work process and the, you know, things related to empowerment of the workers. And that's true. The idea that you can go from a system that is going to lay down everything that you have to do. And, you know, he also cites work done about organizational culture and how that can be, you know, can how that can tighten the limits of the expression of the person, the feeling of, you know, being able to express yourself and see, you know, seek different alternatives to the way to, you can work. It almost like seems a story of unintended consequences if you read through those lenses.
Yes.
That some could
That's a
have,
good point.
You know, it starts as something that we can all agree. And well, in episode 30, we're discussing exactly that, how much autonomy is important for, you know, everyone at the workplace. But at the same time, can serve as a justification of other forms of control. Maybe those are more hidden somehow.
I think it's a great point. One thing that occurred to me as Tom was describing that, and then I was thinking about your reactions, Pedro, was this: the human capital approach, or I think, idealizes the nature of the work relationship. And I was thinking it almost describes or envisions the worker as an artisan, right? And in that kind of work where there's this a lot of creativity involved, a lot of innovation possibilities, gives the worker more options. And if you think about it, that's really describing knowledge work and very high skilled, high intelligence kind of work. When I mean intelligence is, you know, collective intelligence kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And yet that is, I get this nagging feeling because of the way Fleming brought this dark side to light, is that there's a lot of work that doesn't really apply, that's not really that high skilled. I mean, for example, you know, you talk about the Uberization of work, and I don't mean to say driving isn't skilled, but there really isn't a lot of creativity in driving, and it's largely a service activity. And so I do see this dark side where you can take those things and, you know, de-integrate them and basically just focus on the service and the person doing them. And so I think that's one of those unintended consequences you were talking about, Pedro, where it actually disempowers the workers, because as we discussed in episode 18, who do you complain to about your work situation, or who, you know, provide suggestions to, or what have you, if your boss is a computer program that dictates where you go and how much you're paid and those kinds of things?
Or even worse, when your boss says that they're not your boss in the first place, like the case of Uber, that's going to say, you are just a contractor, so in principle you're free, so why should I care about you, you know?
Right.
That's
right.
The whole I agree with you, and I think another aspect we have to see is that, you know, Fleming is looking at a specific sector, which is a majority sector, which has been impacted by Uberization. But of course, there is also the ones that, with this more sense of autonomy that came, you know, the typical, well, I'm trying to think, you know, like high-end contractors, people that really are, you know, high-end consultants, have their boutique consultancy firms and sell their work and feel empowered by the fact that they can really set up their work life and really decide how they're going to, you know, organize the way they're going to go about the work. I think there is like a little niche of people that has been, you know, benefited by that. But the problem is that the majority has not, and has served for, you know, turning service work into a new level of exploitation. In thinking about that, if I may, I was actually thinking again, of course, about Taylor. You know, in a way, it's almost, if I'm reading this correctly, we had this arrival of Taylorism, which took off the artisan craft-like autonomy and, you know, individualized the work, and you have to work according to what has been decided for you. And now what has been described here is a situation in which all this kind of, you know, direct constraint has been taken out, but you don't have any more the resources or the social links or the kind of, you know, occupational community, the artisan-like, you know, universe that you had before.
Yes,
you're left alone. So you don't have either the, I would say, occupational dimension that can, you know, serve as a backdrop for you. You don't have neither the resources from the company, because if you remember, Taylor was very concerned about the health of the worker, the worker having the right tool for the job. You don't have even that anymore. Indeed, Peter Fleming is giving the case of airline pilots, in which they were considered self-employed and have to buy, you know, everything from the badges to the uniforms. So you are completely left as, you know, the worst of two words, so to speak.
Where you're kind of on your own.
I was very interested in this paper because of it sheds light for me on how so many transactions are shifted the power to be able to extract value unevenly. So I wouldn't call it fairly. This fairly might be used also. So you have the taxi drivers who yield such a large fraction of their revenue to the Uber, which is really no different than Red Cab in Washington, D.C. in its fundamental, but it's the fraction that shifted. And because I've actually been talking to taxi drivers in various cities, it's interesting to see, you know, which ones make a living and which ones are merely existing. And so for me, the concern is because carried out to their natural extreme, if they're only existing, they become the fruit vendor in Tunisia, which is they're willing to torch themselves and start, you know, a social movement that basically destroys whole societies because people are just waiting for something to change. So that's why I was very interested, because you can foreseeably extend these ideas to recognize how brittle and how susceptible they make society to collapse.
Well, I thought your point, that comment you made about extracting a value unevenly, what I wrote down in my notes was from labor. I thought that was a brilliant insight.
Yes.
Because I also do some of that, this conversation with cab drivers, at least when English is their language they can speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that in the Netherlands, many, many Uber drivers are actually taxi drivers that they would otherwise not be making any money, because it's basically destroyed that business model in Amsterdam, for example. And so they'll just switch back and forth however they can get the ride. And one of the taxi drivers told me something very similar to what you just said. It's getting very, very difficult to make a living, and they're just hanging on now. And I do wonder about this. People talk about this, the gig economy and all these great things, and have this idea that you can have all this autonomy and choose your hours and those kinds of things. But it bothers me that now that I see that there's this negative aspect. And I think Fleming did a wonderful job. I think some places he exaggerated to make a point, or only kind of looked at the dark side of Taylor. For example, talks about Taylor about completely de-skilling the work and nobody gets to think. But Taylor was motivated, if you read what he's wrote and spoke about, and we discussed that in our first episode, that he wanted to make the life better for workers. He thought he felt that the changes that he recommended would improve work, and it was a neglect of his principles that caused people to just take the easy way out and say, okay, well, we'll just de-skill all the work and you guys don't get to think and everybody act like automatons. And that is the unfortunate aspect of those principles that he enunciated, that they can be used negatively. And I think Fleming is drawing our attention to that as well in this essay.
Yeah, an important difference, though, with Taylorism, was it not the case that throughout that time, the intent was to try to get the most out of workers while keeping them inside the firm, whereas the key contrast that Fleming brings out in, again, it's on page 695, is how employees are now being looked as external to the firm. And that's where the dark side comes in. And all of the things we've been talking about of what we're seeing as manifestations of the dark side is this breakage between the workers being members of the organization and workers being not members of the organization, being on the outside, which provides all of this opportunity to be looked upon as expendable, replaceable, all of those sorts of negative factors that we would not, if they were members of the organization, we would not accept in terms of a command or a organizational climate or a culture.
And I agree that that's a very key point. because it goes to the uneven extraction of value from the transaction. When you believe it to be an arm's length adversarial relationship, then it's in the interest of both parties to get as much as they can. When it's more of a shared relationship, then there's more equity, not necessarily completely, but there's a more equitable view of the situation.
Yeah. That's a good point, sir, where they see mutual interests or overlap of interests. I think that's really important. Tom, I think your observation about workers being seen as external, that's brilliant, because that does lead to all these darker sides. And Fleming talks about in the article, and when he's referring to human capital theory after 695, that in Taylor's day, the work was kind of seen as anybody could do it, right? You're bringing people in from the farms and they don't have any great technical skill or these kind of skills in industrial organizations. So you could replace anybody for that kind of work. And I wonder if, aren't we seeing some of that again? I mean, sure, you have the high-end work that Pedro was talking about, but then we also have this whereas when you're, the employees are seen as external, and I don't need to make any investments, and I'll just go get somebody with the new skills or get people, or why should I make the investment? I've actually heard that before in organizations I would work in. Why should we send the person to training? Because they'll just go someplace else and you know, take those skills elsewhere. Now, an argument I used to make was, well, number one, they're going to do some work for us before they go, so there's still some value in investing in them. But number two, I always felt like, well, if we show that people, there's these development paths for people, even if they go someplace else, and the U.S. military is often has a large component of this philosophy, even if somebody goes someplace else, you're going to attract people who are interested in that capital, human capital development aspect of it. You'll actually get more people coming to the organization. And so in contrast to Joe's uneven extraction of value, it's more like an exchange of value in that kind of a way. So that's one of the models I see operating in the military, but that's obviously not typical of business.
But to kind of say something in reaction to that and also to what we have been saying, I think you can also frame that as, well, you always have to retain people in their jobs. And one way that you can retain them is, of course, by providing training, by making the experience more enriching, by giving them new challenges. So you can also make the argument that, you know, you're going to train them, they're going to leave, but maybe if you train them, you're giving them one more reason to stay, because they might be, you know, more excited about the new tasks they have to do, new challenges they're going to face with the new things you're learning. But I want to go back a bit, and, you know, we have been discussing about the gig economy has winners and losers and how they're distributed unevenly. But I think what I really like about the argument of Fleming is that this is actually coming at a wider scope, and maybe in time is going to influence a number of different occupations, not only the service work in itself. Indeed, he starts the article with the case of the airline pilots, which, if you think about, is a very prestigious occupation.
Absolutely.
You know, so I think that's the idea. What we are seeing here now is actually a way of business trying, you know, a more creative way to cut corners, and, you know, by reorganizing the employment relation, and, you know, using this, well, that's his argument, using theories and arguments like this one of the human capital, to say, hey, deep down, everyone's just selling something. Deep down, everyone responsible for what you're doing. We don't have to have employees. We have to just have, you know, contractors, more or less, or self-employed people. People can just hire for the talent. And, you know, there's no reason why this could not happen to software engineers, nurses, doctors, lawyers.
Well, it's already happened to software engineers, because a lot of that work gets outsourced to Asia and other countries where the compensation is lower. So you're already seeing that, and you do see there are some similar signs where people are using expert systems and those kinds of things, or remote medicine, where they're going to.
Can I just disagree very briefly? I think I agree with you, but the thing is that I think there is a second step. You know, one thing is outsourcing, that's happening. Yeah. But the further thing would be when firms outsourcing or not, do not really hire the people, but they just, you know, hire the skill for a temporary project and pretend there is no real link between the company. They're just paying for what gets done.
I think that's an extension of the idea, which I think is really good. And one thing I was thinking about in this article when we were talking about that kind of outsourcing of employment, I think Joe and Tom will be familiar with this, but when the U.S. government contracts for services, right, we are explicitly going outside the organization for talent. One of the things that you'll hear the contracting people say is, well, you should never send a contractor to training. And with the falsity, like we hired for that skill, we brought them in because they didn't have what we needed, so that we shouldn't have to train them. I mean, it's I think a very good embodiment, and I don't mean that in a positive way, but it's a good example of this idea of that's the responsibility of the contractor to provide that training. And one of the things that I was always torn about in this with that mindset is, well, what if you need to bring somebody in as an extra source of labor or capability, and they don't have the skills that you need, nor does anybody in your organization have the skills, but you need a temporary addition to your workforce, then it's difficult to say that, oh yeah, they should already have this. If you don't believe or are not aware the skill exists anywhere that you need, or it doesn't exist in the way you need it. And so I used to occasionally send contractors to training, not necessarily a long class or something, but seminars and that kind of thing, because I felt that was an important way to develop that skill, but that's frowned upon by the contractor, the contracting officer.
If I can jump on that, there is an interesting and I think an important difference with, say, government contracting, in that the government does not directly contract with individuals, but firms, and so there's that intermediate layer. Now, of course, in the U.S., you have the ability to set up a firm of one in order to compete with government contracts, and that's a whole different thing. But government is just simply looking for, you know, in a technical terms, a service and a function that can be provided through a contract that it could not sustain a requirement for a full-time employee. And that intermediate layer kind of shields the government from worrying about, say, the additional training. Obviously, where that becomes difficult is when you have a skill that really is rare, difficult to cultivate, and you don't have the means of being able to generate that either inside or outside of the organization. And those contracts can be very, very difficult to pursue.
Right. And that's what I was talking about, that kind of work. As opposed to just saying, well, I'm taking somebody's existing job or something that somebody can already do, and I'm just hiring someone to go do that temporarily or even long term.
We might want to, you know, give a general sense of the structure of the essay, of the argument. So what Peter Fleming is trying to do here is that he takes something that is, you know, in a very current phenomena, you know, this growing use of, I would say, creative or problematic employment contracts, from considering people as self-employed to contractors to zero-hour contracts, and, you know, this individualization in which treat workers as a mini company, which, as we know, is very popular in the service sector with things like Uber, Deliveroo, and so on and so forth. And then he says that the underlying that, he's trying to give, you know, an idea, what is the ideological justification, the carrier or the vector that makes possible this understanding of work. And then he goes to explore the human capital theory, which is, you know, presents first, as we discussed, as something that was emerged as a way, you know, to put forward more responsible autonomy for the workers, but actually ended up, whether willing or not, as a way that can be used for exploitation. And then he goes on into listing the specific problems that this arrangement creates.
And then he finishes up with recommendations for how those darker forces or these negative consequences might be resisted. That's the end of the article. And yeah, I think it's worth just examining briefly the problems that Fleming foresees being created by these new employment contracts and human capital theory. And the first one is this idea that it leads to lower incomes and work intensification. So we talked a little bit about that in the case of Uber, where it's driven, you know, in many cities, if you take an Uber ride, it's a half the price of a taxi. Mm-hmm. Well, somebody, you know, I don't know if all that money was what the taxi company was making, but somebody's making less money as a result. And that has consequences for the existing firm. I'm all for innovation and, you know, reducing costs, but it's also, Fleming encourages us to think about what impact that has. Then he also talks about work intensification, which I thought was a really interesting idea. This idea that if you're just, you're external to the company, then he brings up results-oriented work environment, I think is what that is, R-O-W-E. And this, this idea that you put in whatever effort it takes to get something done, and be, and there be, there's no dividing line between public and private use of your time.
No, he also speaks, you know, he talks about the consequence for the workers, as you said, overwork, but also for society at large, because once people do not make enough money, you know, they tend to have to rely on a series of benefits. And as we know, we, all citizens, pay for the benefits that these people must, you know, collect. So in a way, if you have a corporation that doesn't pay people enough, or many times below the minimum wage, they end up having to claim benefits that comes from everyone's pocket. So he makes a claim that, you know, we are in a way giving welfare to companies, really. You know, we are financing their model, which exploits people and takes further money from society.
Yeah, it's interesting. He uses the expression corporate welfare, which in the United States usually refers in the business press to tax breaks and, you know, letting corporations buy land at lower prices, or declaring eminent domain, which basically means you, government confiscates private property so a mall can be built, which was a famous case here in the United States. And I started to see this other aspect of corporate welfare, like Pedro's talking about, that you say, well, we're not going to provide this training and development, and somebody else will do that. They'll just show up with that kind of knowledge. And then if they don't, it leads to these other consequences that Pedro was talking about, where greater forms of assistance, or, you know, government training, or what have you, somebody's going to be spending that money. And then he goes into debt in the dumbed down economy, and, you know, de-skilling of jobs, which I thought was another way to invoke Taylor, make you think more about, is it purely just an issue of greater autonomy, or does it also lead to these other things? Now, one thing I'll give you, just a personal reaction to the debt issue, is that the data is pretty good. There is quite a big issue with debt people are taking on for education. And I used to think, well, you know, perhaps the challenge is they're going to school, very expensive schools, to major in things like marine biology when there are not many employment opportunities in marine biology. And I'm sure some of that exists, but also as the economy is changing, it is entirely possible that people don't know what they should be studying. And so they're, you know, perhaps following a model of, well, I'll just study whatever I like or whatever I think is interesting, and find out that that's actually not what businesses want. So that's not a small issue, understanding kind of what businesses want and where you should be. So I think Fleming rightfully draws our attention to that. And then the third part he brought up that I thought was very surprising, is the idea that in this de-skilling of the work, or the radical responsabilization of work, it actually leads to more management control rather than less.
He has a great example of, you know, a London newspaper in which people were having to use heat trackers, something like that, in which would enable the company to track how long you're going to stay, you're staying at your desk, you know. And these are journalists, you know, it's not people working in factories. So I think it's another example of, you know, changes in the arrangement of work that is not, it's affecting a variety of
occupations. Well, and not only that, and that was a great example, but the workers weren't told that this is what it was for. They were just given these badges and told they had to go wear them. And it was only because somebody went on the web and looked up the manufacturer and found out what it is they were actually being told to wear that they found that out. That was just amazing.
Yeah, the trust factor definitely comes into play, because even when we were talking about the simple outsourcing case, like with the government contractors before, you can imagine that the challenge of the cost of what of the service that you're being provided. So we're moving from an in-house asset, and what we're concerned about is, say, the white space in that individual's calendar that says that if he's only providing so much service over the course of a 40-hour work week or whatever the work week is, there's all of this space that is would seem to be excess. And so let's go to this system to get rid of, you know, to try to minimize the cost of that non-utilization time. So then when you go over to the contracts, though, instead of an in-house assets, now what you're doing is you're introducing in-house contracting assets, in-house contract supervising assets, in-house management over the supervisors. Now what we're doing is we're taking this to an extreme where instead of, say, contracting to a firm to provide a service, hopefully for lower cost, now it's to every single individual. as individual contractors. And yes, of course, I mean, it makes logical sense why the management would have to be intensified, because the overhead in order to make sure that all of these services that by people who are not members of the firm are providing services that are adequate in the name of the firm. It would be like having to have a security camera at every single possible corner of the city in order to monitor adequately, you know, to the same extent that just having an in-house asset would have made things a little bit simpler. But yeah, you can see how this could spiral the more that you diversify or more that you exploit these types of individual contracts, how management would become more intense.
So that was also surprising to me to see that, but it also confirms, like Tom just discussed, the structures that get created to supervise it. And of course, they're internal, right? So that is interesting.
Then it gets even doubly more interesting when the firm decides it wants to outsource the supervision, which happens.
Yes, that's what I was thinking when you were talking about that. What you realize is, you know, you used to have, say, a manager, whether you're 30 people or 10 people, it depends on the organization, you know, reported to him. And now you've got all these individuals working and you don't have managers anymore, or at least that leads to what you're talking about, Tom. Yep. Now, the final part of the article, Fleming talks about how people might resist the human capital hoax, what he calls the human capital hoax. And he certainly sees a stronger role for government. These factors and drivers have real consequences on how people perform at the workplace, the control structures of the workplace, and what Pedro referred to as the corporate welfare of the benefits that people end up having needing when you significantly lower wages.
So what I find interesting here, and of course, Fleming cannot provide all the solutions. Well, he signals some of the things that are already happening, you know, the case of Uber drivers in London who took the issue to court on whether they should be considered employees or self-employed. And, you know, the courts decide that it is, after all, a form of employment because you're selling your service just for one person over, like one company over and over and over. But he also gives other examples of more, I would say, grassroots cooperatives, kind of, you know, new forms of solidarity. He has this discussion that, you know, maybe not a solidarity based on class, but something more at a social level. He talks about things such as universal living wage, you know, a series of, I would say, schemes that could go into providing people with the basic infrastructure for the work they do, given that work is going to become more irregular, you know, so they can make ends meet in this new, I would say, uncertain age.
Well, and I thought that Fleming has a really interesting idea that he talks about in this section where he says, look, if you're using an app, for example, like Uber, to manage the drivers and give direction, why not build in the ability for them to connect via the app? You know, why have the app only focus on the work? So I thought that was a brilliant insight to say you can use the actual control mechanisms themselves. There's no reason why you couldn't build that into the app. It's just was not part of the original thinking of the companies, but it doesn't have to be that way.
Then you give power exactly. You give the workers the possibility to coordinate in action. And actually, Uber, again, is an interesting case because there is a number of, since it's a kind of gig economy or sharing economy activity that is localized, so everyone driving Ubers are driving Ubers at a specific place, you know. So there has been a lot of kind of, you know, resistance, people using WhatsApp, Facebook to organize manifestations, to coordinate, pushback, you know. So people have found ways around it using current technology to create more solidarity. But I'm skeptical how much Uber would like that.
I certainly don't know if they're going to do it on their own, but they're a lot, you know, there's a lot of pressure. They've just recently been decertified or their contract or permission's not been renewed in London. So there are these forces going on, and the author has one of the recommendations that I think connects directly to what Joe said earlier, which I thought was very insightful of Joe. And then the author brings it up here in the last section. And he says, rebalancing, this is on page 703, rebalancing the employer-employee relationship is the only way that the situation might be rectified. And I added the emphasis there, but I thought that goes right to the heart of what Joe said, this unequal extraction of value. And then he has another recommendation on page 704. He did mention the living wage, which I thought was an interesting idea. But he also refers to, and I think this is something that you can see from other reporting, is that deprivatizing the skills pool would mean radically rethinking the provision of higher education and training. I think that's something that's worth thinking about, because these are not small problems. You just say, well, not only are we not providing training, but we have these enormous levels of debt. And I think there's also pressure. I don't know if I would call it the Uberization of work, but this idea of individualizing academic institutions.
Yes, on this issue of education, you know, he proposed something that might be even perceived as kind of, you know, tricky, at least. The idea of debt forgiveness, you know, exactly this point that it has arrived at a certain point in which people has been locked into trying to get tertiary education and have, well, has expected that the rates would stay at a certain level, but that, of course, the economy has moved in a different way and, you know, the original contracts or original expectations were not met, and now people find themselves having to pay almost for half of their life the debt they accumulated just to get a degree, which was perceived as a necessary step for any kind of job in this current economy.
The history on debt forgiveness is very interesting. Normally, the forces that have acquired the debt and hold the debt are so powerful that literally the only way it ever gets forgiven is for a revolution that wipes them out. Because even if there's a revolution and they survive, they manage to get their debt reinstated. And so, you know, there have been very few successes. And if you look at Iceland in the 2012 timeframe, in all of the threats and promises about how Iceland would be blasted back to a third world country if they walked away from their debt, which when you look at it had actually been, there were obviously a few Icelanders involved in it, but it really was the Wall Street bankers figuring out there's a pocket of wealth mm-hmm. there we can tap into. If things turn south, we'll get paid mm-hmm. back. And so the debt forgiveness, I hold little hope for that happening, because it has been historically has happened so rarely.
I would also be concerned that by forgiving the debt, if the system is not changed, then all we will do is create the same debt or even worse debt in the future. Debt forgiveness has got to be like step True. One of a much, much broader process that it hasn't been as much of the conversation.
Argentina would agree with you on that.
I mean, and that's a classic case where, you know, they wrote off their debt, and then still people, you know, bought the debt secondhand or third hand and then went after them and were able to prevail in court. It's amazing.
And I think that the whole, I mean, we're talking about that, but the real issue here is education.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Who should pay for education to go, you know, to what you're talking before. And I think the conundrum here, which is funny for me, because, well, I studied in Italy, and I remember I sometimes have discussion with friends, because in many courses, there is no limit to how many people can enroll in a specific course. You know, so you might have a course of psychology in a big city like Rome with hundreds of people, and then it's up to the university to try to, you know, manage the logistics of, you know, everyone attending classes or giving, you know, for going for the exams. And I was arguing that, you know, I find this a bit, you know, weird, and I would expect them to have a limited number of people that they are going to accept. And then the pushback that a friend of mine said, you know, well, the point is that education should be a right. So if you limit the numbers, then it's not a right anymore. And of course, things have changed, and there is, you know, many courses in Italy have limited numbers, especially like medicine or things that involves laboratories. But I remember that this conversation stuck with me, you know, because I've never thought about tertiary education in such a way that is just education, especially if you consider in light of, you know, the discussions of the knowledge economy or how much more educated people with higher degrees can, in a way, help the economy. Because you're going to have a workforce that can deal with tasks that are of aggregated value.
I think that connects to whether human capital is a public or private good, right? If you see this tertiary education as a public good, having a more mm-hmm. educated workforce or populace be a public benefit, yes. then you'll be more inclined to finance it publicly. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you say it's all just private and what the individual wants to do, then you're going to, people are going to make the argument, well, then why should the government be spending that money? And just to finish up with this final section, I think Joe brought up a really interesting point about debt forgiveness. Now, that's not a small issue. And I think it could be argued, and I'm not sure Fleming's doing that directly, but I think it could be argued that is going to be the driver to get people to wake up and say, what kind of changes do we need? And not because it's the primary problem. It's actually a symptom or a secondary problem of a much larger issue that I think Fleming is drawing our attention to in the article. That's what I think is really interesting about the way he brought that up, because I wouldn't have seen it that way initially.
To rewind a bit, you know, as we see, the essay is very compelling, you know, and triggers a number of discussions on very heated topics. And I think Fleming is very successful in trying to show something that seems a bit hard to pin down. That is, what is the kind of the idea underlying ideology that supports changes in the way work is organized? And so by rereading Human Capital from a different angle and showing what are the either intended or non-intended consequences, the way it can be used to justify, either in court on a social level, more exploitative kinds of employment and work practices. And he shows, you know, as we discussed, the number of negative consequences it has, not only for workers, for society, you know, for the way management is structured, for everyone, really. And, well, in this, we discussed the possible, I would say, not really solutions, but more almost like, you know, room for resistance or for rethinking that, while very interesting, still are going to need a lot of practical and maybe even theoretical work to be worked out how we're going to go about dealing with this new arrangement that we are seeing.
And that's all for part one of episode 36. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about our podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we'd love to receive via Twitter, Facebook, or via our website. Don't forget that we now have a newsletter that comes out the day after each episode and contains some bonus and unique content. You can subscribe to that using your email only on our website. Please join us next time as we discuss part two of Peter Fleming's The Human Capital Hoax: Work, Debt, and Insecurity in the Era of Uberization, here on Talking About Organizations.